two Israelis are killed in a shooting in the occupied West Bank as tensions remain high over the regime's aggression against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israeli regime warplanes carry out airstrikes on several positions in the besieged Gaza Strip and Lebanon. Plus, the U.S. releases a report on its 2021 withdrawal from Afghanistan, admitting there were massive intelligence failures in the process. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story: Israeli forces have once again attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied West Bank. Troops stormed the holy site early Friday, and that was the latest in a series of attacks by Israeli forces against Palestinians at the mosque this week. First one took place early Wednesday, leaving hundreds of Palestinians injured. Hundreds more were also arrested. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is the third holiest site in the Islamic world. Israeli aggression against the mosque has drawn widespread condemnation. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the aggression will not go unanswered, said the movement, along with the Palestinian people, will continue to defend the Al-Aqsa. Now, Daniel Yagich is an author and researcher. We asked him earlier about Israel's recurrent acts of violence against Palestinians and how the international community, particularly the West, is responding.
The Zionist regime cannot exist and cannot survive without this continuous barbaric violence that it is inflicting on the indigenous Palestinians, and which it also is inflicting beyond Palestine, in fact. So we see that every year, as you mentioned, for major significant holidays, these humiliations and attacks and torture and killing of people at the hands of settlers and the Zionist regime, again, as part of this very colonial conquest, because the Zionist regime cannot sustain itself without this continuous violence on which it was actually built. The Zionist colony emerged through tactics of terrorism and genocidal killings and expulsion of the indigenous people. So it is very much the essence of, I think, what Zionism represents. There is no way to ever rely on the so-called international community, in particular the West, even when there were some maybe slight moments of some sort of criticism from the West. None of this has ever led to any actual actions being taken against the Zionist regime. On the contrary, actually, the Zionist regime serves as a proxy for the United States, in many ways, as the European Union does as well. So, and we've seen again how Palestinian, Lebanese, and Syrian resistance are being condemned, and it's over and over again the same language used by the West and by the also the UN, which has a very imbalanced internal power relations.
The Israeli army says that two women have been killed and another wounded in a shooting attack in the occupied West Bank. The incident took place near a settlement of Hamra. The Palestinian resistance groups have hailed it as an anti-Israel operation, saying it's a natural response to crimes by the Israeli regime and its aggression against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Our correspondent to Ramallah, Monu Kandil, has the details.
Israeli military declared that they found a vehicle crashed in the Jordan Valley. First of all, they thought it was an accident, but then they said there were gunshots at the vehicle. The Israeli military launched a manhunt in search for those who carried out the operation, because the Israelis say they think that at least two Palestinians were in their vehicle and carried out this shooting. Military checkpoints were set in the Jordan Valley at the entrances to Nablus area and northern the occupied West Bank, as well as at the entrances to the city of Jericho, also known as Ariha. Whether the those who carried out the operation could driven towards Jericho. So the search and the manhunt is going on. Palestinian resistance groups immediately praised this operation, saying that it would be a natural response to the non-stop aggression against the Palestinians. Hamas movement said it's a natural response to the aggression and the attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Palestinian worshippers in the last few days during the holy month of Ramadan, as well as the attacks on the Gaza Strip and Lebanon as well.
Israel has carried out airstrikes in the besieged Gaza Strip and Lebanon, claims that strikes targeted positions belonging to the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas in both territories. Loud blasts rocked different areas of Gaza on Friday night. No casualties were reported. Palestinians fired salvos of rockets in response. Now Hamas has reacted, saying Israel is fully responsible for the consequences of its aggression against Gaza. Now in Lebanon, the Israeli military also launched air raids in the south of the country. They hit areas near the city of Tyre, with the Israeli regime saying it struck Hamas positions. Tel Aviv says its attacks on both Gaza and Lebanon were in response to earlier rockets fired from those regions. The two casualties were caused by Israeli strikes in Lebanon. And now, as our correspondent Maddie Amsalli reports from the town of Tyre, Israeli strikes hit civilian areas in Lebanon.
Just to see the type of these strikes that we saw in Lebanon, the Israeli army has claimed that it has targeted areas that are posts for or Hamas targets. What we saw the first time was basically banana trees and fresh water supplies. What we're seeing right now here, this is the second target, which is basically a barnyard, and the target mainly hit this small barn, which shows that, of course, we had a very small rocket, not an airplane rocket, not an Air Force rocket, perhaps a reconnaissance plane or a drone that launched this small rocket. It's not very large in size. We don't see a lot of casualties. This barn is still intact, actually. Perhaps a little bit of some of its ceiling has been blown away. We saw also some of the livestock in this area lose their life, but absolutely no human casualties, and even this place is still intact. Basically, what the Israelis are trying to sell to their populace and their people are mainly, so far, just baseless lies.
And earlier, we also spoke to our Gaza correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, about latest Israeli airstrikes on the besieged enclave. He says attacks are an attempt by the Israeli regime to cover up for its internal conflicts.
It seems that the right-wing Israeli government, especially Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, under the premiership of Benjamin Netanyahu, are trying to create a war against the Palestinians to try and cover up for internal problems within the Israeli regime. Since yesterday, we've seen dozens of Israeli airstrikes being carried out against the Gaza Strip, and also seen the Palestinian resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, firing rockets towards the Israeli regime. What I've seen so far is that both sides, the Israeli regime and Palestinian resistance factions, are not, are not increasing their attacks or carrying out major attacks on both sides. Seemingly, they're both trying to avoid a major war.
And now, foreign ministers of Iran and Saudi Arabia have held a first official meeting in the Chinese capital, Beijing, 7 years after the relations were severed. Now, top diplomats agreed to reopen the respective embassies, reestablish direct flights, and implement previously signed cooperation agreements. Gisu Mishahmadi has your details.
The dawn of a new age, a new era of regional cooperation begins as the foreign ministers of Iran and Saudi Arabia meet for the first time in 7 years. The result of Beijing's efforts after 2 years of negotiations that began in Baghdad and continued in Muscat at an expert level. With a strong political will from both Iran and Saudi Arabia, those talks eventually led to this high-level meeting as Tehran and Riyadh turn a new page in their bilateral relations.
It is with great pleasure that we announce today that we have officially resumed our bilateral relations. This comes after three rounds of telephone conversations between the foreign ministers of Iran and Saudi Arabia. The next step will be reopening our embassies and consulates, which is scheduled for the coming days.
This marks the first official meeting between the two sides, moving towards a promising future, as they describe their meetings and negotiations as excellent and moving forward, and with both top diplomats agreeing to pick up where they left off 7 years ago.
Two rounds of talks were held. There was a private meeting and a public meeting. Regional security was discussed, and the foreign ministers decided to implement the agreements that had been previously signed between the two countries, including the 2001 Comprehensive Cooperation Agreement.
The comprehensive deal signed between the two countries back in 2001 entails a wide range of areas of cooperation, from business, trade, and investments to boosting regional security. A win-win deal considering the immense potential that currently exists and can also reshape the political landscape of the region.
We do not see Iran and Saudi Arabia's relations limited to their bilateral cooperation. Instead, we have defined a broad horizon. Both countries are significant players on a regional and international scale. You probably remember the doctrine where the two countries were seen as rivals, but now we have redefined their role as allies with great potential for cooperation. This is the most important outcome of the meetings and marks a new era of relations that can affect the region and beyond in a positive way.
With the world's second-largest economy in the mix, particularly as a mediator that enjoys strong ties with both Iran and Saudi Arabia, and considering Beijing's ambitious plans for future economic development, the final statement signed by Iran and Saudi Arabia's top diplomats can be seen as a game-changer. 2 years of negotiations have resulted in this historic meeting, a significant political development that is sure to change the political equations of the region. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Beijing.
And earlier, geopolitical analyst Jeff Brown joined us with his take on Iran and Saudi Arabia moving to restore relations.
I think it all goes back to Saudi Arabia seeing that Iran was incorporated into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran has been working tirelessly with China to integrate itself into the Belt and Road Initiative, along with Russia, with the North-South corridor down to the Persian Gulf. And also the BRICS, Iran wants to join BRICS, and Saudi Arabia saw that. I think that Saudi Arabia is being very, very, very wise to work with China and Iran, because they want now to be in all three of those. They want to be in the Shanghai, the SCO, BRICS, and the Belt and Road Initiative. So it's going to be great for the, and China, in spite of all of the horrific Sinophobic racist propaganda and the Western big lie propaganda machine, China has always, its diplomacy has always been about win-win, mutually beneficial cooperation.
Now, China has slapped sanctions on two American entities and their directors after the Taiwanese president met with the U.S. House Speaker in California. Now, sanctions target the Hudson Institute think tank and the Reagan Library, as well as four people with top positions there. China's foreign ministry says the two institutions provided Taiwan's president Tsai Ing-wen with a platform to engage in separatist activities in America. Now, sanctions prevent Chinese organizations from conducting transactions and cooperating with the two targeted entities. Those blacklisted are also subjected to financial sanctions and other restrictive measures. Tsai Ing-wen sat down with the U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy this Wednesday at the Reagan Library. Meeting took place despite warnings from China, which considers Taiwan as part of its territory. Meanwhile, the White House has released a redacted report on America's chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan, admitting to a massive intelligence failure. Reports said U.S. intelligence services failed to understand the strength of the Taliban and the weaknesses of Afghan forces. It, however, blamed the failure on a deal struck between the former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration and the Taliban. Report claims deal put President Joe Biden's administration in an impossible situation because it had a date for withdrawal but no plan to execute it. 13 U.S. troops and 170 Afghans were killed during U.S.'s pullout from the country in August 2021. Political commentator Tim Anderson shared his views with us on the released report about the U.S. hasty withdrawal from Afghanistan. Have a listen.
Everyone knows it was a failure of a illegitimate occupation, and they confronted resistance they hadn't expected. The only wins really were that they had propaganda wins in amongst Western audiences claiming that they were there for the rights of women and girls, and a lot of silly people in the West still believe these sorts of propaganda campaigns. But no, everyone knows it was an abject failure, and every other collaborator of the US in the region took the lesson from that, that they can be abandoned and they'll be in very deep problems if when the US runs away and leaves them behind. Occupations cannot recreate legitimate, stable governments. They attempt to create a puppet government in their interests, and people simply do not accept that. There is an innate resistance. People want the right to self-determination. They come together and they form resistance of different degrees. It happened to be very strong resistance in Afghanistan, sustained over a long period of time. Whatever you think of the Taliban, it was a tremendous effort to kick out the biggest army in the world, but they did it. And you see a similar thing happen in every other country, basically, to different degrees.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Iran claims that it is building nuclear fuel cycle facilities primarily to meet future electricity needs while preserving oil and gas for export. On the other hand, Western critics say that Iran's gas reserves are the second largest in the world, and Iran flares enough gas annually to generate electricity equivalent to the output of four Bushehr reactors. Meanwhile, independent experts suggest that, considering the historic difficulties that U.S. policymakers have had with petroleum economics, it seems possible that these assertions are wrong. Because Iran's dependence on export revenue for now suggests that it could need nuclear power as badly as it claims. Recent analyses project that oil exports could go to zero within 12 to 19 years. It therefore seems genuine that Iran needs nuclear power in response to the anticipated export revenue shortfalls. The Islamic Republic of Iran is among the world's top eight countries that possesses a complete nuclear fuel cycle. In the nuclear science and industry, Iranian scientists have made so much progress that they can design modern fuel themselves instead of reverse engineering and using others' designs, which is a great scientific achievement for anyone.
Iranian officials believe that in the view of the war in Ukraine and the unprecedented energy crisis that Europe has been facing, if nuclear talks conclude and unilateral and illegal sanctions are lifted, Iran can meet a larger part of Europe's needs. Naturally, Iran is one of the most important countries supplying fuel and energy needed by different countries in the world due to its rich oil and gas resources. Based on its capabilities and capacities, Iran has been able to maintain its presence in the energy market even under the toughest sanctions. To take a closer look at what's actually taking place on the ground, please join us on this edition of Iran Today. Iran designated April 9th as the National Nuclear Technology Day back in 2006 when the country enriched uranium on an industrial scale for the first time. Since then, the country has seen steady progress in the sector, from building nuclear power plants to centrifuges and radiopharmaceuticals. This national day is seen as an occasion for the country to reaffirm its right to a peaceful nuclear energy program. Sanctions have been haunting Iran's nuclear industry since the country indigenized the key sector. Tehran calls the sanctions illegal and unfair, for it has insisted since before the conclusion of the 2015 JCPOA, also known as the nuclear deal, or up until now, weapons of mass destruction have no place on the Islamic Republic's agenda, and that its nuclear program is totally civilian.
In my opinion, Iran fulfilled its obligations, reduced its uranium enrichment, and practically turned its Fordow plant into a research center so that Natanz becomes Iran's only enrichment center. Iran did all these measures because it was optimistic about the West. Iran also started reducing its commitments based on the strategic law of the parliament. Iran first increased the enrichment from 3.60% to 20%, restarted the Fordow power plant, and increased its enrichment to 60% by installing new centrifuges. Of course, all this was based on the JCPOA and under the supervision of the agency's inspections.
Under the JCPOA, Iran made a series of commitments, including eliminating its stockpile of medium-enriched uranium, cutting its stockpile of low-enriched uranium by 98%, and reducing the number of its gas centrifuges by about two-thirds. Iran also agreed not to build any new heavy water facilities for an extended period of time. To monitor and verify Iran's compliance with the agreement, the International Atomic Energy Agency was given regular access to all Iranian nuclear facilities. The agreement provided that in return for verifiably abiding by its commitments, Iran will receive relief from the U.S., European Union, and United Nations Security Council nuclear-related sanctions. Accordingly, in May 2019, the IAEA certified that Iran was abiding by the deal's main terms. However, unilateral sanctions reimposed by the United States in 2018 inflicted an estimated $1 trillion worth of damage on Iran's economy, and Tehran expects compensation now. In the history of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, no country other than Iran has ever voluntarily agreed to put such extraordinary restrictions on its nuclear activities, according to an IAEA expert.
Iran has always had full cooperation with the IAEA and allowed for inspection of its nuclear sites, but calls the nuclear agency's maneuvers against Iran destructive. Iranian officials claim that the recent issues and approaches adopted by the IAEA are based on U.S.-Israeli deceptions. Therefore, Tehran has asked the IAEA to stop politicizing issues and focus on the technical aspects in line with the organization's mandate. In the past, they have called on Director General of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, to stop Israeli influence approach on other findings and emphasize that Tehran will never surrender to the political behavior of the UN nuclear watchdog that is affected by Zionist pressures.
The main point is that Israel is not a member of human rights organizations at all. Although it's not a member of the NPT at all, it comments against Iran's peaceful nuclear activities and has no commitment to any international organization. It is said that Israel has between 250 and 400 nuclear warheads. They themselves implicitly confirm this issue, but they have never allowed a single inspector from the Atomic Energy Agency to visit their nuclear arsenals. This is despite the fact that there are hundreds of cameras in Iran and countless inspections are carried out intrusively.
Iran's nuclear program was probed by a record number of international inspections last year as monitors were given broad access to atomic data and facilities. The IAEA conducted more than one inspection a day in 2022 among Iran's 21 declared nuclear facilities, the Vienna-based agency said this month in a restricted report leaked to the Western media. Inspections rose to a record even after Iran's decision to hold back some data and prevent snap visits from February 2021. While IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi said his inspectors were seriously affected by Iran's decision to stop implementation of the 2015 agreement as it responded to Trump's illegal withdrawal, they continued verifying uranium inventories. Since Iran curtailed its sweeping access after the 2018, the IAEA negotiated a series of side agreements to retain agency video footage inside places where inspectors are no longer welcomed. The agency stands ready to tackle the intense verification challenges should the JCPOA be restored, Grossi said. Inspectors continue to gain access to Iran under the IAEA's so-called Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement, which is the standard set of rules adopted by most countries as part of their commitments under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran could restrict monitoring even further by leaving the NPT, as it has repeatedly warned to do so if it's referred back to the United Nations Security Council by any twisted method of justification.
In the JCPOA, they promised that the Arak reactor would be built with Iranian experts under Chinese supervision and with American scientific approval. The United States withdrew from the JCPOA in 2015 and did not fulfill its promises at all. After the withdrawal of the United States, England was supposed to help Iran instead, but this did not happen. China was not satisfied to implement its commitment in this partnership either. Another promise that was made and was not fulfilled is the issue of nuclear cooperation between Iran and the Western countries. They had promised that under the JCPOA, they would help Iran's peaceful nuclear activities. Not only did they not help, but they imposed more sanctions against us. There were other commitments in the field of economic activities and the lifting of sanctions, which, it is clear, were not fulfilled in any way, but more sanctions were imposed against the Iranian nation.
In March 2023, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency issued a joint statement at the end of the two-day visit of the agency director. They agreed that Iran, on a voluntary basis, will continue to allow the IAE to implement further appropriate verification and monitoring activities. Modalities regarding Iran's new advancements will be agreed between the two sides in the course of a technical meeting, which will take place soon in Tehran.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media.
Here's how it looks on the page. English Al Arabiya reads, Iran minister interested in developing peaceful nuclear energy with Russia, RIA. Iran is ready to expand its cooperation with Russia in the energy sector, including in the development of peaceful nuclear energy. Iranian Economy Minister Ehsan Khanduzi said in an interview with Russia's RIA state news agency. The prospect of cooperation in the field of new energy and renewable energy sources, as well as in the field of other types of energy, including peaceful nuclear energy, certainly causes great interest and motivation for expanding economic relations with Russia, Khanduzi said in remarks published on Tuesday. IFP News says, Iran says ready for nuclear cooperation with Saudi Arabia. The director of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the country will definitely engage in nuclear cooperation with Saudi Arabia. Mohammad Islami referred to messages Iran has received from the Saudi side that shows Riyadh is pleased with the recent rapprochement with Tehran. He said in order to serve the people of Saudi Arabia, the two countries will work in the field of radio medicine. Islami further spoke of Iran's achievements in nuclear technology, saying the country has made a PET scan machine that is used for diagnosis of cancer. According to Tasnim News, Iran to conduct hot testing of nuclear fuel transportation container. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran unveiled plans for the hot testing of a container used for the transportation of fuel of reactors at the country's Bushehr nuclear power plant. Speaking to reporters on Saturday, Mohammad Islami said the standard and safe container for the transportation of Bushehr nuclear power plant's fuel is being shipped from the southern port city of Bandar Abbas to the Bushehr port and needs to undergo hot testing. Hailing the AEOI's progress in the current Iranian year, which ends on Monday, Islami said that domestic scientists have crowned more than 150 research and technological achievements. He also highlighted the nuclear industry's contribution to the medical sector, noting that over 300 patients have received plasma therapy treatment in the past months. In January, Islami said Iran is ranked among the world's top five countries in the production of radiopharmaceuticals, which are exported to 9 foreign countries. This year will be the 17th year Iran celebrates a national day to mark its achievements in the nuclear industry. Iran in recent years has made great headways in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment in the area of peaceful nuclear technology.
I think the most important achievement of Iran's nuclear industry is self-confidence. It is valuable that some young people around 25 years old together with Iranian scientists around 50 years old got together in a professional collaboration and formed three teams. The first team designing Iran's peaceful nuclear activities, the second team implementing what have been designed, and the third team utilizing the attempts and products of the previous two teams under the supervision of the Atomic Energy Agency. In my opinion, this self-belief and teamwork was a great achievement that showed that the Iranian people can stand on their own feet and achieve this technology. This was while no country was willing to provide nuclear technology to Iran.
A while back, the head of Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, said that homegrown radiopharmaceuticals have been produced for the treatment of cancer and will enter its clinical phase after receiving license from the Ministry of Health and Medical Education. While expounding on programs devised at Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Islami reiterated that the organization will unveil important programs and achievements in the fields of health, agriculture, and radiation of products and food on National Nuclear Technology Day.
In our cement industry, there is a substance called californium-252, which is maybe the size of a peanut. You can put this under the conveyor belt that is producing the product, and then you know what purity it has and what it has without having to take the product to the lab. Well, when you don't have this, you have to transport 10 tons of the product to the laboratory. Well, how are these materials obtained? Of course, through the nuclear industry. in the areas of drilling wells, oils, for example, to be able to identify what oil is like, how much it is, or underground water. All of these require atomic materials.
Moreover, Iran has previously announced the production of several radio medicines, including lutetium-177, to treat a number of difficult-to-treat diseases like cancer. With a half-life of 7 days, Iranian-made LU-177 will have a stronger effect compared to LU-77 and is the indigenized version of the medicine. LU-177 works to destroy cancerous tumors by connecting to the receptors of the tumor and spreading rays in the affected area. This mechanism helps prevent metastasis by disrupting blood circulation around the tumor. It is a type of radionuclide which has drawn attention from global scientists. The new generation LU-177 has low-energy photons and facilitates gamma camera imaging.
The nuclear industry is a must for countries that have a medium size like ours, that is countries with a relatively large population, 80 or 90 million people. Why? Because the nuclear industry is related to the pharmaceuticals, and Iran has at least 1 million patients who are using radiopharmaceuticals. And you should know that Pars Isotope Company, which operates in this field, wrote a letter in which it is stated that the U.S. government says it has not put sanctions on medicine, and sent a letter to the U.S. Treasury Department. The U.S. government first said that the letter was under investigation. Then again it asked for more information and finally announced that you are affiliated with the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. In fact, they make excuses for not providing service to Iran. They know that by doing this, they are depriving the Iranian nation of radiopharmaceuticals.
Possessing 50 types of radiopharmaceuticals, Iran ranks first in the region and exports its products to other countries. Iran had also earlier produced other radiopharmaceuticals, including samarium-153, phosphorus-32, yttrium-90, and iodine. Referring to the fact that Iran is now among the top and prominent countries in the field of nuclear knowledge, Islami noted that Iran obtained this knowledge by relying on its own human resources.
We definitely need nuclear power. In your electricity basket, you cannot just rely on hydroelectricity. Well, our hydroelectricity supply is about 12% now. At one time, it supplied 18%. As much as the rainfall decreases, it also decreases. Even I want to say that you cannot always rely on electricity that comes from wind and sun. So, you have to produce electricity that is non-polluting, like atomic electricity. A country like Iran, which has enough engineers and has enough education, must have atomic electricity and use it in various fields, such as agriculture and industry.
The enemies did whatever they could to prevent the Islamic Republic from reaching these achievements in the nuclear industry. For instance, some of the sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation include banning the import of 20% purity uranium needed for producing pharmaceuticals used in cancer therapy and treatment of certain diseases. More than 1 million Iranian patients use nuclear medicine annually. This is a very important issue since today many countries are facing serious problems due to lack of nuclear drugs. No country in history has been subjected to such technological and scientific sanctions like Iran.
Ever since Iran's nuclear case was brought up in the world community in 2002, Israel started sabotaging Iran's nuclear facilities. This project of theirs in the fight against Iran's peaceful nuclear activity is not limited to military dimensions only, but also has political and technical dimensions. The Stuxnet virus that happened in the Bushehr power plant could have turned into a global disaster like the Chernobyl. But Israel is not worried at all. It carries out the operation very easily, or the attack that was carried out on the Natanz facilities in June 2021. Israel was indirectly responsible for this, and Iran also announced that this sabotage is related to Israel. In addition to these, we should not forget the assassination of nuclear scientists. The cabinet of the Zionist regime allocates $3 billion of funds for a military attack on Iran's nuclear facilities.
Iran's nuclear field has become such an issue that the state terrorists of America and Israel have made a lot of covert plans and projects to destroy it, one of which was Stuxnet. According to experts, Stuxnet is a powerful computer worm designed by U.S. and Israeli intelligence to disable a key part of the Iranian nuclear program. Targeted at an air-gapped facility and unexpectedly spread to the outside computer systems, raising a number of questions about its design and purpose.
As you know, when Ariel Sharon becomes the Prime Minister of Israel, Dagon becomes the head of the Mossad. Dagon's last mission was to stop Iran's nuclear program. Dagon himself, who is now dead, writes in his memoirs and admits that the first action against the Iranian nation was to prepare a list of Iran's nuclear and defense scientists. Then, he says, we came up with a list of 10 people and planned to eliminate them. 2 days before the assassination of Martir Rezainejad, the head of the military intelligence service of the Israeli army says that if a scientist is killed in Iran, he will not shed tears because of it.
In addition, Iranian nuclear scientists have repeatedly fallen victim to the Israeli regime's state terrorism in recent years, while the international community has kept silent. Iran has made it clear that these crimes won't go unpunished. The criminal act of assassinating nuclear scientists is an obvious breach of human rights.
Yes, I know that these assassinations are the work of the Israelis. But the main issue here is that, for example, the Human Rights Organization, Amnesty International, or the United Nations cannot say with certainty that Israel has assassinated the Iranian scientists, because Israel basically adopts a policy of ambiguity. Look at the recent attacks in Damascus. It never accepts responsibility. Whatever crime Israel has committed, not only against Iran, but also the assassination of Iraqi, Egyptian, or Syrian nuclear scientists, Israel never accepts responsibility, because it wants to follow its policy of ambiguity. This ambiguity policy is a strategic policy for Israel.
Between 2010 and 2012, four Iranian nuclear scientists, Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Daryush Rezai Nejad, and Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan were assassinated, while another was wounded in an attempted murder. In November 2020, another scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was assassinated.
If you examine the fake history of the Zionist regime and look at their destructive actions all over the world, you will see that the policy of assassinating scientists is part of Israel's project. Assassination of Egyptian scientists, assassination of Iraqi scientists, assassination of Pakistani scientists, and some other countries and even European. If the Israeli government identifies a scientist who can lead his or her country to nuclear development and technology, it will definitely assassinate them. The Zionist regime has become bolder because the world and international entities have decided to keep silent.
Of course, these terrorist acts did not deal more than a tactical setback to Iran's nuclear ambitions, analysts say. International experts indicate that an efficient system has been established which is able to pursue the envisioned projects without any hindrance. They also suggest that the loss of the scientists, who are known in Iran as nuclear martyrs, might have prompted students in other fields to switch to nuclear science. Indeed, Iran needs many more scientists to achieve its ultimate goals of building more nuclear reactors, and extensive use of renewable energies are on the agenda of the government. Today, the nuclear economy has great added value and zero pollution, and is considered the cleanest way to produce electricity around the globe, which is why Iranian leaders want to take long strides ahead in nuclear sciences and technology.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do tune in same time next week and each week after. Till next time, take care.
From our Imams, the ninth Imam is the first. whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam al-Jawad was the 9th divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Messenger of Allah. The most famous scholars of Imam al-Jawad's time asked His Eminence some of the most complicated philosophical, theological, and jurisprudential questions. And we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam answered each and every single one of them. Among these great and famous scholars of the time was Yahya bin Aktham, the chief of the judges of Baghdad, whom the Abbasids had chosen to test Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Yahya bin Aktham asked Imam al-Jawad about a jurisprudential question, and Imam al-Jawad ramified the question into several branches, and then asked Yahya which branch he meant. The chief judge did not know what to say and could not save himself from that embarrassing situation, and confessed that he could not keep up pace with Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, who was still in his tender youth.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are humbly at your service talking about the dialogues of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Of course, who was the 9th divinely appointed Imam. We find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam spoke about some beautiful akhlaqi, moral, and ethical virtues that an individual must have. Now, of course, we know that the divinely appointed imams were the leaders of the Muslim Ummah. They were divinely appointed by the Almighty Allah. They were the religious leaders and the religious source for knowledge and wisdom. And, of course, when it came to the socio-political aspect, they were the people who were the leaders and the guides appointed again from the Almighty Allah. Now, along with trying to reform the society, we find that the divinely appointed imams, they also opposed the taghuti and rebellious political establishments of their time, of course, because it was these political establishments that were creating and spreading and nurturing and promoting various kind of corruptions and unethical qualities, evil attributes, and the like among the people. And of course, this was slowly deteriorating the individuals and the families and the various communities within the Muslim Ummah. Now, because of this, of course, we find that the imams focused a lot on these kind of spiritual and purification matters. In one such conversation where these kind of various virtues were being spoken about in a gathering of companions,
of the Imam alayhi salam. And of course, they were talking about some medical aspects of the body and how one can keep the body healthy. Now, of course, we would kind of think about, not eating a lot of fats, not eating a lot of carbohydrates, or not eating or drinking sugary foods or sugary drinks. But here, the Imam says something very beautiful. Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam, he responds and he says that one who conceals their grief makes their body ill. Very interesting. One of the things, therefore, that we must do practically in the present day for our health and the health of our physical body is to not conceal our grief. Now, I believe sometimes this is known to be called bottling up something inside. And so that's what the term is to bottle up something, to keep something inside, to not let this grief out, to not relieve oneself of a certain grief. Now, this doesn't mean that we go and we complain to everybody and anybody. No, but there are certain ways for one to relieve themselves of this grief that sometimes one is faced with. Now, of course, the primary way in order to be able to relieve ourselves of grief is to turn towards the Almighty Allah, speak with the Almighty Allah, tell Allah our problems, our needs, our requests, our desires, our flaws, our mistakes. And this is one way in order for us to be able to relieve ourselves from grief. And of course, in modern science also, it is very clearly said that if one conceals and bottles up their grief, it does have negative repercussions on the body, on the mind, and eventually on the soul. So don't conceal your grief. Speak with the Almighty Allah, and this is one way to keep your body healthy. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyarah Text of Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
السلام عليك أيها النور الساطع السلام عليك أيها البدر الطالع السلام
Peace be upon you, O shining light. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O Immaculate from among the Immaculate Ones. Peace be upon you, O Pleased and Pure. Peace be upon you, O Aba Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.